Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. On this episode, I interview Lisa Marie Bazile and Joanna C. Valente, who are the founding editor-in-chief and managing editor, respectively, of Luna Luna Magazine, which is described on its website, lunalunamagazine.com, as, quote, a growing community and online diary interested in art, feminism, literature, opinion, sex, and the occult, with content generally divided between dark and light sections. Lisa founded Luna Luna in 2013, and I began by asking what inspired her to do so.
I was working for a school that was just pretty terrible. It was one of the jobs I had right out of grad school. So I was bored and unfulfilled, and I remember wanting to do something that I felt mattered and made an impact. So I kind of thought up Luna Luna just as an aside, a blog, somewhere to put my thoughts. And I had 10 of my friends come on and help me build the website and contribute blog copy every week, really kind of informally. And from there, it just took flight and people were catching on and the traffic was actually growing, which wasn't something I'd expected at all. So then I thought to myself, you know, maybe this is more than just a side project. It should be one of my focuses as a writer and an editor. We eventually just bought our .com, which made us legit, and we started having a schedule and posting more and more content, and it got picked up by other, you know, magazines, and our content was syndicated, and that's when I knew that people really cared for it. And yeah, I wanted a place to explore darkness and sexuality and also art and opinion. So I wanted everything that a woman would possibly want to talk about in one place.
So Joanna, how did you get involved in Luna Luna magazine?
So I became shortly involved a few months after, just because for whatever reason, I can't even remember now, I saw a posting about it on Facebook. You know, if you had essays, please send them. And I had just so happened to write an essay on my sexual assault. And it was actually the first essay I had ever written about it. So I was like, okay, this seems perfect because it's the exact subject matter that the call was for. So I sent it and then Lisa loved it, posted it. And shortly after that, Lisa had organized a New York City meetup for the Luna writers that were already writing. So I ended up going because Lisa and I at that point sort of always, I guess, were part of the same relative group of poets, but never actually formally met before. Like, she went to the New School and I went to Sarah Lawrence. It was kind of like a hilarious, like, rival MFA thing. So we finally met and, like, we obviously, like, got along really well because now, literally, I think three, four years later, I basically just worked my way up to being managing editor just because I was writing all the time, so much to the point that, like, I just kept doing more and more stuff and then started editing, and now I'm helping run the magazine with Lisa, and it's been an amazing time. I mean, we're also really close, you know, best friends, so it's kind of interesting, even, like, not just on, like, the professional note, but on, like, the personal note, how it's sort of changed things. But it does seem kind of funny how, like, blurry it also seems. Like, I can't remember a lot of the small details now.
Lisa, tell me about the plans for Luna Luna in 2017.
2017, I think, is going to be the year where we decide to probably grow our staff a little bit more. The end of 2016, we brought on about 8 people who were contributing semi-regularly. I think 2017 is also going to be the year that we expand our editorial focus in terms of making sure that we have diverse coverage, making sure that the content that we're doing is new and fresh. So kind of looking for people that can bring a new voice, a new spark, a new essence to the site. I think we're also probably going to try to focus a little bit more on our social media presence, growing that, because as it is right now, we just kind of let it happen on its own. And we're lucky to have thousands of followers, but I think with a little bit more of a push, we can really build out and find our audiences. One of the things that I talked about doing last year that I really want to make happen this year is get a Patreon page and try to find some even minimal funding so that we can at least pay for long features or AdWords or something that will boost Luna's presence and boost the radio signal for us. You know, between me and Joanna, we're always coming up with new ideas of what to do and new issues, new things to focus on. So I'm sure we'll come up with a lot to do this year. But it's a volunteer, you know, game. So it happens a little bit more slowly than we probably like.
So Joanna, since you came on board Luna Luna, how has editing changed for you? Has it shifted in terms of the topics you're covering, the kind of writers who are writing for Luna Luna?
I would say for me, I've just expanded my horizon, I think, a lot. I think when I initially began Luna or editing at Luna, I was really young. I mean, it was like 3 or 4 years ago, so I was like 23, 24, something like that. So I think at the time, it's almost hard for me to separate that in some way because I had just graduated from my MFA and I was mostly in the poetry world because that's what I studied. And I hardly really ever ventured into nonfiction prose all that much. So I think it really like blossomed me in a lot of ways because now I'm really focused on editing, writing, and curating pieces on sexual assault, gender identity, sexuality, occult and witchcraft stuff, because I also like that world. And as a tarot reader, it's interesting for me. But I guess, you know, say 3, 4 years ago, it never really occurred to me to write or edit those pieces. I'm not sure why. I think just because I was so immersed in such a like intense program where all I did was like breathe poems all the time. Whereas I think I feel like now, especially in the wake of Trump, it's so important to tell different stories from different perspectives. And I think for me, that's actually more important in some way than just being a poetry editor, because I do edit a poetry magazine on the side. And that's something I do separate from Luna, but I kind of look at it as two separate things, because I think for Luna, my vision for what I do is more about like activism, if that makes sense. Like even if I am interviewing someone who's like part of a band or wrote a book, it's usually because I think like the work that they're doing is really important to what is happening right now. And I think Lisa can agree with me on that, that that is more important, I think, than anything, about like keeping it fresh and also keeping it honest and real. And I think that's also important change for me, because I think when I was younger, I was very much like about the surreal and the strange, hence why I like, you know, occult and ghost stories and things. Whereas now that's less of a important thing for me. I'm much more about the nitty gritty real life stories that we often don't always tell, or often don't tell honestly, because we feel like we have to make our lives either more tragic or better than they are. Because I think a lot of times that sort of in between seems to not get as much traction on the internet, if that makes sense.
So I'd love to hear some of your own writing. Let's start with you, Lisa. Tell me about what you're going to read.
I recently was lucky enough to be published at the Atlas Review, which is edited by Natalie Albert. And I just want to say that I really adore her as a writer and an editor. And I think she's got such a fine, tremendous eye for work. So I'm just really grateful that she published one of my poems. I'm going to read that poem. It's called A Summer, and it is part of a collaborative novella I worked on with a poet named Alyssa Morehart Goldstein called Nympholepsy. A Summer. Satin shorts twisted up in the center of us. Summer wet, folds of skin lapping, debased by liquor tonight, this black, blinding night. Splayed out, we are splayed out over grass and folding chairs and wooden chairs. A wading pool with a bobbing bottle of kava, excess pouring, and grass stuck on our elbows. Hose water pooling around a statue in the dirt. Do you understand? We're almost fucking, but we're not. We're all tongue. We're all tongue down the glass, mouth open and taking. No, we're not. We're wasted on memory tonight. We're fucking memories. I don't come easily to the night, but when I do, I am the night. Me and some girls, we command it. The high priestesses of one another and our revenge kill. We slaughter happily the language of the past. Oh, that's the night we're fucking with the slick, oily, dark dick of goodbye and the wicked wheel turning inside of us away toward the somewhere that isn't here. Do you taste that? That's the salt of us turning away.
Thank you, Lisa. Now shifting over to Joanna. Joanna, what are you going to be reading?
I'm going to be reading a poem I actually wrote about Trump's election that was published at Tarpaulin Sky Press. And I'm really grateful that they published it because they're such a beautiful magazine and press. And Christian was really sweet to ask me to write anything about the election. And I wrote this the day after. So this was pretty much my initial reaction. It's called Donald Trump Becoming President Means My Body Is on a Witch Trial. You saw it coming as you flipped to the next card. The present, the future. Your body doesn't know the better option, only feels the burning in a blaze of black fire, in a thousand desiccating suns as they die, heating the earth, and the overwhelming voice that fills your head says, "We deserve it." I thought God was dead when he grabbed my pussy and shoved his cock inside a hole in my body where it could fit. Even when I said no, when my hands flailed like the sun descending erratically, making strange sounds for this new world. I watched as my people fell from the sky out of long coffins that rose from the ground to where my mom told me angels live. But I stopped believing in them when the black smoke rose and never left. Once I asked the sky, "Why did you leave us? Where are your hands? Where is the carcass that holds the heart that houses our hearts? Where is the ocean that can't live without light?" I work for the newspapers. When I was a child, I'd believe in what the newspapers told me. All those faces drowned, all those men tearing other men apart with glass soda bottles in their bare hands. And this is when I saw the moon vanish from the sky, and only the sun remained. And as a kid, I thought, this would be cool, having eternal light. But it hurt so much. It hurt too much. "Are we being punished?" a child asks her mother on the R train, and the mother shakes her head and looks at the ground as if a snake or angel will appear. She's not sure which. At this point, she's not sure which is even the better option. Somewhere outside, a man lighting a cigarette doesn't understand what he has done wrong. Somewhere a child sees a newspaper headline, wonders if their dog could read, if God looks like a dog, and if that dog could also read. I see the child I grew in my uterus, the same child who was never born, on the subway platform, and I don't feel regret, only bellyful of resentment for the men who hate my body because of what it can do. They try to stop it, control it, and all I can do is cackle while I push their heads underwater. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanna. Those are two very evocative pieces that both of you just read, and I'd like to hear about how you guys find inspiration and connected with that when you have time to express it. I'll start with you, Lisa. Tell me about where you're drawing inspiration these days from, and when do you find time and write poetry?
So I'm a very slow worker. I used to be very prolific, but I've been much more focused on trying to write the exact thing that's in my mind. That could be a limitation, and for many it probably is. But I find comfort in working slowly. So I do try to write at least once a week, which I know is crazy compared to some poets who probably write every day. I kind of like to let things swim a little bit, but I do try to make a ritual of it and at least dedicate one day of my week to writing and editing. I think for most of my life, I found inspiration in building a world that on the outset looked like it had nothing to do with reality and that it was just a place of beauty, but that told the story of my life in more, I suppose, metaphorical ways. I feel very protective of my reality as a poet versus as an essayist. So I like to shroud it and kind of build a protective wall around what I feel and what I think. So a lot of my poetry doesn't read as real, but it is very real. I find inspiration in our desires, in relationships with girls, meaning female friendships, and in death and loss. I try to create a world that builds that beauty, but with underscores of truth and sadness. I guess those are the things I feel most often. But this year, I've been thinking a lot about telling my own personal story as a poet and exploring new forms, so possibly getting a little bit more raw and a little bit more real and showing a side of myself that probably will be very challenging, but that will allow me to kind of be more upfront. So using less metaphorical language to tell my story. I think that's probably the most roundabout answer I could give you.
And for you, Joanna, where do you find inspiration from, and when do you find time to express it?
I think for me, I try to do a little bit every day, which is kind of funny because I guess Lisa and I are a little bit opposite in that way, but also similar because I think part of it is that I am a staff writer for my day job. So I am literally writing every day, even if it's not for me. And I think that in itself is kind of a curse and a blessing, in the sense that it's a blessing because I'm always writing and I'm always thinking of words and like everything that's happening, like current events, I'm often writing about. So in that sense, I often feel like I'm getting inspiration just for my job in general, because I do work for a women's site for my day job. So I'm always thinking about all of these issues. I also think, ironically, though, when I go home, like I do have a lot of energy to write, but I'm also often at a loss for what to say. And I don't think that's because I'm writing all day. I think it's just because I do work somewhat slowly, similar to Lisa in some sense, because I do need to sort of feel my writing in my body first. I think I often have to write in my head and really explore whatever topic I'm exploring for like weeks or months even. And then all of a sudden, like, I have to write because it's like been bubbling up in me for a really long time. So I think for me, it's kind of a mix of things, because I set aside usually at least 2 hours a week just to write and edit, which involves like scheduling Luna posts or other things that I do, and just write for myself and just like try to actually edit or write my own poems. And I usually do that on like a Sunday morning, because I feel like that way I've like let myself enjoy my Friday and Saturday and feel like I'm not overworking myself. But I also don't force myself to write creatively every day. Like, so when I say I do write every day for myself, it's kind of like I maybe write some notes in my iPhone about like a cool outfit someone wore, or just like random thoughts that I think when I'm walking, because I often get my best ideas or thoughts when I'm walking to the subway to work or home. So it's usually something like that. I'm not really writing actual poems like every day, because that would be intense. Like this month I wrote one poem. So I'm not even like trying to pretend that I'm like always super prolific. I'm just really prolific in spurts. So like I'll maybe write like 5 poems in a week if I'm having a good week, and then like write one poem in like 2 months. So I think I'm also just really forgiving of myself. In terms of where the inspiration comes from, I think just like the unknown. Like I've always been obsessed with like what I don't understand, and like human interactions and mundane conversations that I have with people. Like, I think if you read my poems, they're like really about one moment, and there's always dialogue in the poem. So it's always about the silences and what's been sort of left unsaid, and me sort of trying to deconstruct that.
So Joanna, let's do another round of readings. Tell me about this piece.
So this piece, which is titled Look for the Silver Lining, was published in an issue of the James Franco Review. There was a sign on the door, "Jesus don't live here anymore." The black paint chipped in a way where you know no one has been home for a long time. There's a spider hanging loose from its web, waiting for a mate, and the taste of the first bite, the perverted hope in his flesh. It's the same want to make the man who strangled you dickless. Drain the power from his body, piece by piece. This man said, "You learned to exaggerate, to get a reaction from other men. It's what everyone in the magazines say. And you still love him sometimes, and you wish you didn't. I tell myself I've forgotten you, that you came to me in a dream, hovering over my bed like a man in a black suit. I don't know if you are real or if it's the dream that is real. I don't know which version of me is the real one, but I'll let you choose the most flattering version. That smell of wet skin burning, erosion by human. Sometimes I'm turned on by my own death. Thank you."
Thank you, Joanna. Lisa, tell me about what you're going to read next.
Actually, I'm going to read a poem that was also published on Tarpaulin Sky post-election. I'm not a political poet, but this was important to me. It is called On Begging. "My dear, I will be long gone by the time you see the efforts of human madness take shape." He says this as I wriggle in place, the bloodlet of light at my feet, the foul bloodless in power. "The emptiness won," I say. "The steeple fell. It pierced the earth. There was nothing seeping out, nothing that we can see. Shall we plant our last goodness into the earth? Choose the light. Or choose a semblance of light," I say. "For me. For me. For me. Choose any particle of light you see. Hold out your hand and catch it. Let it burrow into your ancestry. Those dark-haired fathers, fathers, fathers that have been denounced and called sin. We are sin, then, my father. We are sin. Find it in you to unsin, to see sin as construction, to undo the sharp white cut of death we have become. Oh, that we have become death. We find ourselves inside death. I say, find the light for me, father. Find it for me. Now, before the end, do not leave me in mourning for more than your body. Do not leave me mourning for this land. He says he will pray, but oh, they are such culpable gods. What divine craft pulls from us that slick, emetic contempt? What angel fell so hard into revolt against the light? What has he done snuck up into our veins? What has he done in the garden at night? Bully the grass into brownness? What daughter must beg upon her final breath? What daughter must face the sky in search of liberation? What light must be gone, my love?"
Thank you, Lisa. Let's talk about a topic that Luna Luna covers very often. I'd love to hear your take on it. The occult.
Yes.
Why is the occult a focus of Luna Luna magazine?
I've been asking myself that question for so long. Just why it's a focus in general at all right now. I recently wrote a piece for Refinery29 examining this very topic. Why are we so pulled toward the occult? And why for so long was it considered a weird kind of alt lifestyle focus? And now it's really a positive thing. I'm happy to say that Luna was writing about the occult 4 years ago, maybe before it really kind of became a focus again for people. But I think part of it is that the occult allows you to find your autonomy and explore your dark and your light sides. Obviously, that's not a perfect binary by any means, but I think the occult gives you the chance to look at your life and what's happening around you and try to harness either some energy or control or insight, intuit something from it, and turn it into something else. So whether you're actually doing a spell to, say, secure a job, or you're just trying to kind of cast a sacred circle, that is literally a metaphorical representation of you saying, I want my space and my body and myself to be happy and find peace. I think the occult gives you the chance to do something ritualistic that means something to you. And I think for women, the occult is especially important because for so long, our bodies were not our own. And with magic and ritual and just looking at the history of occult, whether or not you partake, you're really able to see the way that inner magic and inner power was looked at as a bad thing. And now we have the opportunity to really, at least in this country, celebrate it. So why wouldn't we? That's why we've been focusing on it. And I think we're going to do way more occult content. We've had some people come on recently who are writing amazing stuff. So I'm very happy to be part of that conversation.
So Joanna, tell me your thoughts about the occult and working with Luna that has such a focus on it.
I think a lot of what I feel Lisa said, but I also think for me, and I think this is true for a lot of people, I've always been interested in the occult, partly because it's mysterious and, you know, we always want to know things that are kind of secret, you know, and we're like fascinated by things we don't understand. And I think I've always been drawn to that as someone who's always felt like an outsider, because I've never really felt like I was part of any particular group or, and I think that's a lot of it just stems from childhood. And like, I was the, you know, quintessential quiet goth kid who like was teased and like didn't really have many friends, and like I just made art and wrote poems like listening to The Cure when I was 12, which is fine. But I think because of that, I kind of grew up with this outsider fascination, which is also why I loved, you know, punk and goth music and like, you know, listening to like funk and all of these different things. But I think that's the same sort of interest that like fuels the occult in general, why people also start reading tarot or start being interested in these rituals, because they're looking for something that they're not getting from their personal relationships, and they're trying to find connections with other people and hopefully meet people by doing those things. I also think like there's just a lack of, I would say, religious fervor in the U.S. right now, and spirituality in general, I think, is in this really weird like gray area where, you know, we don't have that sort of like Catholic mentality that most people grew up with, or like this like very Christian mentality that a lot of people grew up with in like the 60s. And I think because of that, people are becoming more and more interested in like alternative ways for finding like a spiritual connection with the outside world and the universe and within yourself. And I think a lot of organized religions just aren't really speaking to people who are younger, like millennials or even younger than that. I know that's the case for me because I grew up in a super religious Greek Orthodox family and went to Catholic school for like 13 years. And I always felt very outside of it, and felt, especially as someone who, you know, grew up in a woman's body that it just wasn't speaking to me. Like, I wasn't allowed to have sex until I was married, and like, you're not supposed to have abortions, and like, all of these things like didn't seem fair to me. Or just like the fact that, like, you know, the Catholic sort of stance on homosexuality, like, officially is not very accepting. So I think for me, like, I was like, where do I fit in? Because I do believe in a God or a spirit of sorts. So I think I felt like I wanted to find that in a way that felt real and authentic to me, and not just like I was going to church to please my parents and feel like it was just some fake entity that we're like praying to. Like, I feel like a pizza God felt more real to me. Or a cat god. I would be about the cat god, personally.
Let's keep with the theme of family. Recently, you and your sister Stephanie did a collaboration with my colleague here at Radio Free Brooklyn, Christine Stoddard, who is the host of Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn. She also oversees Quail Bell magazine. Tell me about that collaboration.
Sure. So it was actually kind of funny because my sister and I always talked about collaborating, and then we never did. Ever for some reason. I guess we just got busy with our own work. And Christine actually ended up posting about how she wanted like people to photograph. And we both said that we were interested. And she was like, oh my God, this is like so perfect because you guys are sisters. I could do this cute, like, witchy sister photo shoot with you guys. So we did. And it was great. It was really interesting just like being photographed alongside my sister, because I normally don't model for anything. So I also feel like I'm the most awkward human making like weird faces, but it worked. I mean, she made us look really cool. But then after that, Christine asked us to write poems about the experience. And it was interesting because my sister and I talked a little bit about how we would write the poems. And I was just kind of like, let's just do it. Like, just write your own poem and I'll just write my own poem. And that was kind of the initial thought behind it. And we were just didn't even really talk much. And then we sent Christine those poems. And Christine was like, oh, can you guys also write like a poem together? Not just like separate poems. And I didn't know what to do. So I just kind of like deferred to my sister and was like, can you start the poem? I was like really just trying not to do it for some reason. I was like, I don't know how to do this. Like, I just want to take control over this whole poem. But she started it, and I kind of liked that she did, because not only metaphorically speaking, she's the older sister, so I kind of let her take the rein on that a little bit, but I also felt like I was seeing where she was coming from, and then I was able to kind of put myself in the persona that she chose, if that makes sense. And I love writing a persona, so I found it really interesting to also think, you know, is this my sister or is this persona? And I know the answer to that, obviously, is a poet. Writer myself. And then we just actually keep doing it. We keep writing these poems. She'll start them and then I'll finish them. And I'm not really sure why we've decided this is the better method, but I kind of like the idea of her having this hopeful beginning and then I sort of destroy it because I'm Zool incarnate or something. Because I do notice that happens. Like, she'll be, like, the much more, like, positive one in the poem, and then I'm just kind of like, fuck all this shit. I'm ruining it.
And that was an excellent Ghostbusters reference, by the way, Joanna. Well done.
Of course. It's true.
It really is. Lisa, let's stick with the topic of photographs. What's the photographic strategy for Luna Luna? And does that bleed over into your own social media approach to photography to help promote both Luna Luna as its own entity and also you and your writers and editors as your own kind of, for lack of a better word, I apologize, brand entities?
Yes. So Luna Luna is unfortunately burdened with an incredibly anal retentive boss bitch, meaning me, when it comes to the creative direction. I am luckily surrounded by people who agree with my creative aesthetic, but I really do not want to compromise it. And I think it has been a major part of our branding. So I personally, as a person outside of Luna, I've always been really attracted to great photography, a lot of double exposure, vintage photographs, depictions of the body in interesting ways. It's really, you know, I'm not an artist, so it's hard for me to describe exactly what I love, but I know it when I see it. And I think, amazingly, we've all kind of understood that, and it's taken shape at Luna. So the photographs are like very part and parcel with the content, and it's mostly Joanna and I doing any of the real like posting. So we're primarily the ones picking the artwork to go along with things. As a poet, I'm extraordinarily image focused. So a lot of what I see in my mind or want to write about, I try to find photographs that depict that in some way, and we use it at Luna. So I feel like each post kind of has its own piece of content, but it's also like a display of art in itself. We always credit the artist. We try to link back to their work. But I'm so in love with the spooky and the dark and the sexual without it being over the top or ridiculous. And I think a bad photo destroys digital media, and I think a great photo elevates it. So I would say that I very fiercely protect that branding, but we've had, you know, so many great people with great ideas come on board to expand upon that vision.
Let's talk about one of those ideas. I believe it was last fall you guys did a photo shoot in a park where it was your coven of ladies, and it was one of the more evocative series that I've seen you post on, say, Facebook. Can you tell me about how that idea came together and what the concept was?
Actually, our friend Leza Cantoral, she wrote a book and had us, the Luna crew, our coven, so to speak, come together and do a shoot to promote her book as a book trailer. And then I took a bunch of photos just of us in the park and kind of put it up as a photo series. You know, I guess if I had my way and a huge budget, it would probably have been way eerier than just being in the sunlight in a park. But, you know, it turned out beautifully. And I also wish that the people in the photographs would have represented our whole entire crew, because there was only a handful of us really that were in the photographs. So didn't show the real scope of who we are. But it was a really incredible opportunity to get together and actually show ourselves and our crew and our power. And it doesn't hurt that like everyone on our team is just stunning and magical to look at.
Excellent. Turning back to the power of poetry, Lisa, tell me about this piece.
So this piece is from my book Apocryphal, which came out in 2014 from Noctuary Press. It's published on Beffroi, which is actually the same people that run Queen Mob's Tea House, where I've recently come on as a contributing editor. So this is called In This Story. In this story, there is the me, but not me. The me before breaking. And look, there's my father. Do you smell that? It's summer cologne and old gin cupboards. A cream-colored dawn. Let me really set the scene for you. In youth, I was so beautiful, whole houses shut their mouths when I came, barefoot to stand on porches, dropping to my knees at the window to watch him and her recklessly, their Polaroid pornography on that plastic couch, coral walls, ice cream, organ song. The only thing the body knows of desire is its surroundings. So beautiful that my hair unbraids itself, unraveling as stray pearls on the nightstand, which roll eventually to land in your lap and look up at you as a girl, gagging on cock. We drive a pale cherry Buick Riviera, his golden hair wrapped in bandana, and me? I'm in polyblend ivory and damp, smoking and coughing, the shame smell in back seats crawling up into me forever. How will this ever unhaunt me? Rain perpetually at my window, on his side, aureate, and he smiles white as though it were his birthday. He was born in 1960 and stinks of it. A golden gilded framed father thing with his foot on the brake, with his foot on the brake, with a marble hanging. When I blink, a photograph emerges. Later, I will use this image to construct my lovers and build my entire life. I will say, "Do you drive a Buick?" And they will say no. And I will say, "Do you make music?" And they will say no. And I will say, "Will you leave me?" And they will say no. So I will go. Later, we're at the electric tower, where I am in stiletto, amaretto for an older boy who likes pigtails and tries to make me wear them, the engine humming. I like to think it has 1,000 rhinestones inside of it, and I am spitting and sucking off his triumph and wiping it off, feeling the possession of summer down my neck, down hanging out the window with my small magenta mouth thinking hard of our childhood beach house, me sitting on their laps, lapping them up. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Joanna, tell me about this piece.
This piece is titled Creation Myth, and this is actually one of the poems in my third book that just came out, titled Marys of the Sea. This poem was published actually several years ago at the Paris American, and it's funny because the reason why I chose to read this poem is because the other day a woman came up to me after a reading and she was saying how she read this poem of mine and she like put it on her Facebook like with her profile picture and it was really weird and amazing. So I just thought of this poem. You ask me why I never pressed charges. I drink the rest of my gin and tonic, begin to tell you how a man discovered eternal life in 1988. He found it on the ocean floor. Instead of dying, jellyfish age in reverse, bury themselves until tiny flecks rise and gleams, endlessly rocking. An injured medusa will sink and reabsorb into the ocean floor. It will wait. Eventually, a polyp will form to reproduce a medusa. The easiest way to make a jellyfish regenerate is to mutilate it. It does not feel when attacked. Someday I won't feel anymore either. We both play dumb when the bartender asks if we're okay. I rock my chair the way a mother rocks her child. Ocean rocking a sailboat in arms of salt. Self-control is difficult for humans. Our hearts still primitive. I scratch its skin until a new layer reveals impermeable. In the dim light of the bar, all the bodies so dense, pores secreting black, they almost disappear. When it's time, you ask my name. Look for Jays. You'll find them everywhere. 24-hour diners, cliffside harbors in low sunlight, hotel rooms with unsure women. I was there once, in a room with a man. It was late winter in a big city where lights no longer cared about sounds during sex. He taught me how to keep my body still and thin as pine needles, how to listen to Billie Holiday cry in the back seat of my car, how to take a pill so a child dies, how every spring fewer azaleas stay in bloom. I smelled my cunt souring, something gone wrong, violence never far from the hands of men, hands around neck, my life still believing in the yet to be. The future has changed. Early bloomer still waiting for the one poem that will bring me home. I didn't tell you how I used to think of all the ways to fall in front of cars, sacrifice my body to get what I had before. I used to pray for a new body by moonlight, a return to being human. I leave without giving you my name. I do not believe in punishment. Thank you.
Well done. Thank you, Joanna. Finally, I'd like to hear from each of you about something that you read recently that either inspired you, made you mad, got an emotional reaction. Not news, but literature, poem, opinion, something personal. I'll start with you, Lisa.
There's a lot to be read right now, and I, I've been devouring the news, but I think I keep coming back to literature for peace of mind. And one of the things that I reread most recently, just finished it the other day, was Practicalities by Marguerite Duras. And, you know, she's written The Lover. I think everyone's read that book. But she's an incredible writer. And her book Practicalities is just a compilation of vignettes that she had written and reorganized and reorganized and reorganized, thinking there would be some sort of shape to it, but then she finally just let it be a thing that was just vignettes, page by page, no real story arc, looking at the life around her and herself within it. And this might seem a bit random, but I chose that book to reread on a plane ride back to the United States this holiday. And I wanted to sit with it because I feel like there's a lot of power to be found in just writing your truth and not having to write for anyone and not having to say something specific or important, just writing. And although her intention in the end obviously was to release this collection, she had always been kind of just writing. And you can tell from reading it. And it really explores just the world around her, her alcoholism, her sadness. And for me, it inspired me because it kind of freed me from this idea that I must write a piece that could potentially be published in X journal or write a piece that would be publishable at these markets rather than just writing. Just writing because it's freeing and beautiful. And Duras and Anais Nin, who both, Anais Nin kept a diary all of her life. Both of those writers have been tremendously, and perhaps it's a cliche, but tremendously inspirational to me to just be able to be a person who has feelings and to write them and explore them. And I think right now is a time where any art matters because we are struggling and oftentimes it is difficult to say and feel the right thing. And there's so much around you happening. But I think to just kind of erase everything and just create is what's really going to matter in the end, especially right now. So Practicalities by Duras.
Joanna?
I feel like everything I read gets muddled, but that also is a sign that when something doesn't, it's good. I think mine is not quite as like powerful as Lisa's in some way, in the sense that I have a few things, not just one particular thing. So last night I actually ended up teaching an online workshop for Monstering magazine and White Winter Tangerine magazine. And one of the poems that I taught was Natalie Eilbert's Black Tourmaline. And just teaching it and reading it to the class, even though I had chosen it on purpose because it's an amazing poem that talks about mental health and isolation, there's something about reading it last night to my class that it really felt so powerful to me. And I just saw like this black pond, like as I was reading it, just in my head. And just the feeling of knowing that we both shared the same sense of isolation was powerful, but also the idea that this is someone that I know and someone who's like living and breathing right now. It was amazing to me that this like writer is doing that. It's just such an honest and real poem, even though it did have metaphors and beautiful images. I also feel like we live in an age where we're so ingrained and surrounded by social media and just like creating these like somewhat fake false personas for ourselves and brands, which is what magazines and writers do, not even on purpose, just because you sort of have to. And I think because of that, though, it was refreshing for me to see that. I would say in general, Joshua Jennifer Espinosa's book, There Will Be Flowers, was a really groundbreaking book in general, but also for me. It's a book that basically really focuses on gender and body and what it means to identify as something. And I think like the poems were just incredible. And I think for me, especially as someone who has questioned both their gender and sexuality and has, you know, sort of had a very long like journey in figuring out what that is for me, I think I read it at the right time because it was just released last year. And I think that's a book that everybody should read because I think it doesn't necessarily give you answers, but it asks the right questions, if that makes sense. And I think Joshua Jennifer has a really great ability of writing in a really creepy way, which I love. She's amazing at being honest, but also making it feel as if every poem is about the apocalypse and like the world is about to end. And I'm about that always. And I think the last thing that I can say, and this is really the opposite reaction, it like inspired a lot of frustration for me. It's really nerdy. I read Harry Potter and the Cursed Child recently, and it just is so upsetting as a piece of literature. And I think, I hate to say that was like really the first thing I thought of when you asked the question. I thought of all of the things I hated first. Just because, like, I say this as a Harry Potter fan. Like, I grew up with Harry Potter. I loved it. I breathed it. It was, like, all about witchcraft and magic and all of the things that I love. So when I, you know, read the books, I was the age of Harry Potter. So then when I found out that she was writing a play, I was kind of skeptical just because part of me was like, well, you were done with this, you know, series a while ago and it was great. As it was. And then I saw she didn't actually write it. Other people wrote it and she like put her name on it, basically, like she approved it. So I was even more skeptical. And I'm just not the biggest fan of like sequel type stuff because it was not even about Harry so much as his kids. So anyway, I read it because I figured why not be fair and as neutral as possible. And it was, like, really not even good fan fiction. And just it angers me, just, like, as an artist, you know, I think we have to hold ourselves to, like, integrity and, like, authenticity. And I understand, like, with J.K. Rowling, like, some people wouldn't consider her an artist. They would just consider her a writer who's writing maybe entertaining books. And I don't think that's necessarily fair to say, because I think the idea of creating art or good literature is just to get people to read it. Like, who are we to say what has more value or artistry than other people? And I think, like, Harry Potter, even though it is, like, entertaining for a lot of people, like, it inspires kids to read and adults to read and, like, be part of this strange, mystical, magical world. And I just feel like putting out a book that's obviously not of the same sort of standard and isn't even written by the person who like created it. It just seems strange to me. And it just like made me feel like she was doing it for the money. Even though I still respect her, I also felt like it was a disappointing career choice. And like, there was definitely some typos in there. It just like was weird for me. So yeah, mad. But I guess it's good because it made me think about what literature is.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
You can read more of Lisa's work and more of Joanna's work and read Luna Luna content at lunalunamagazine.com. Talking Paper interviews like this one are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now Season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Give as much as you'd like and get great perks in return. Next, here is an October 2016 essay from Luna Luna magazine by Olivia Kate Cerrone titled Tarot as Family Therapy. Around my mother's candlelit dining table, several relatives sat beside me, each taking a turn to shuffle through a Rider-Waite tarot deck. Each shared a specific concern before a handful of cards were selected at random and placed in the classic Celtic cross formation. In the wake of an aunt's sudden and untimely death last year, my family reunited through a series of polite dinners and strained holiday events, our bonds reemerging after a long winter of estrangement. Gathered before the tarot, our presence served as an unlikely but inevitable means to deepen our reconciliation. Ours was a family with an inclination toward the supernatural. Growing up, I enjoyed hearing the stories of cousins and aunts who spoke of visions and dreams involving visitations from the dead or foretelling warnings of illness or death. Family tarot readings were one of my earliest memories, a tradition perhaps as old as the Sicilian folk rituals practiced among my great aunts and grandmothers who, on occasion, would flick droplets of oil into a pot of boiling water, hoping to decipher il malocchio, the evil eye. The shape that the oil took to water could reveal who wished ill against you. These were conversations held behind closed doors, in hushed whispers. Not everyone in the family approved of these habits. I still remember the fear and disgust in the gaze of my paternal grandmother, a devout Catholic, when I mentioned seeing a psychic with some high school friends, as if I'd already invited the devil inside. Still, we found comfort in tarot, dealing in these psychological symbols to access the subconscious, thanks perhaps to something mysterious ingrained in our genes. In Sicily, the traditions between paganism and Catholic traditions so often intersect, echoing the ancient worship of Demeter and Persephone, goddesses who symbolized the harvest and the seasons, the cyclical nature of death and renewal. Ritual evoked protection against what was unknown, and therefore threatening. Sicily, an island rooted in trauma, has had its fair share of conquerors, war and political corruption, the violence of the mafia, severe poverty, and the ongoing refugee crisis. Superstition and fear, the all-consuming venom of jealousy and bitterness, seemed imprinted upon our collective psyche in consequence. How could we learn to trust again? One by one, the cards revealed our individual angst, the fallout of bad choices, the slow-healing wounds of heartache and betrayal, the ennui of unfulfilling careers and dreams left undernourished. There was a chilling accuracy to the cards, not exactly predicting the future, but offering a kind of tough love, ready to inform you of what you needed to hear, rather than what you might wish. Our readings echoed one another, with certain cards reappearing. The Three of Swords spoke of open wounds still festering from the past, while the Nine of Swords illuminated the more hidden issues of fear distorting truth and fostering misunderstanding. The Eight of Cups cautioned in maintaining safe boundaries at all costs. The Death card indicated transformation, a path of transcendence through healing, if we were open to it. We listened carefully and debated meaning, taking what we found seriously, even if it was also entertaining. In tarot, we could suspend disbelief and indulge in the possibilities of the unknown. Here, we could hope for a better fortune in one another's cards, while revealing intimate truths difficult to express otherwise. In those moments, around the tarot, we found, if only briefly, some familial closeness. Finally, I read from a modern examination of a 19th century literary rendition of a German legend of the occult. This is a portion from the 2014 English language edition of Lothar Müller's History of Paper, titled White Magic. In this chapter, Müller discusses the use of paper in Johann Wolfgang von Goethe's stage play Faust, the first part of which premiered in 1829. Faust lived in the world of books. Around 1800, Goethe placed him in the study where he soliloquized on his disillusionment with book learning. In his conversation with Mephistopheles, he nearly flies off the handle when Mephisto demands, quote, a line or two in writing to seal the deal instead of settling for a handshake and, quote, man's word. Quote, a formal deed with seal and signature, a specter this from which all shrink afraid. The word resigns its essence in the pen. Leather and wax usurp the mastery then. There is an irony in the fact that Faust ends his philippic against the world of documents by making an offer which implies he has every writing surface and writing instrument since antiquity right there in his study. Quote, spirit of evil, what dost thou require? Brass, marble, parchment, paper? Shall I use style, pen, or graver? Name which you desire. This grandiloquent tirade falls flat because Mephisto is too modern to be held up by a recap of writing materials and their respective implements. He tacitly assumes that paper is a suitable medium for a document and slips into the role of a spry secretary, pulling from his bag a prepared contract, which merely needs to be signed. Quote, with passion why so hotly burn, and thus your eloquence inflame? The merest scrap will serve our turn, and with a drop of blood you'll sign your name. Mephisto is in tune with the times. He brings the turbulence associated with bills, credit, and speculation into the old ritual of the pact with the devil. The lurid, grotesquely archaic signature in blood ratifies a diminutive piece of paper, a scrap, which is readily to hand, yet also capable of outlasting the lifespan of a man of books who is obsessed with the present. Mephisto's scrap returns in the second part of Faust, in a world in which paper has left bronze, stone, and parchment far behind, and devoted itself entirely to banking in the form of money. In brief, paper in the modern era shared the legacy of the old transmission media oriented on time as duration, going all the way back to stone, while also associating itself with accelerating circulation of people, goods, and money. It was a precursor to digital media in the analog world. To listen to past episodes of Talking Paper, check out our podcasts at audioboom.com/channel/Talking Paper. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.